This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to, I guess, the first autumnal, I love saying that word, edition of Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martoreno. We are here each and every week talking about the disease of addiction, the problems that occur with substance abuse, and the road to recovery. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat, premier addiction treatment centers, about which more a little later. So much of the news about substance abuse and the opioid epidemic is grim. Family shattered, lives destroyed, lives lost, that periodically on Recovery Radio, we want to remind people of another aspect of this entire story, and that is that people do get better. People do achieve long-term successful sobriety. In fact, millions do. And so in spite of the fact that this is not a great topic and it's not a fun one, and as I said, the toll is enormous and self-evident, we want to bring a voice in recovery to you every now and then so that you know, as difficult a problem as this disease is, it can be managed and people can live whole and happy lives through sobriety and recovery. To that end, we welcome to the program Nick Antos, who is an alumni of Retreat's treatment facility. And Nick is now in his sixth year of sobriety. So we welcome him to the program. Nick, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So let's, you know, we like to begin these stories at the very beginning. Tell us about yourself. How old are you? Where were you brought up? What was the family like?
I'm 52 years old. I was brought up in Reading, Pennsylvania, just outside of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I'm the youngest of three. I have a brother and a sister, and mother and father are still married after 60 some odd years. They're going through some health issues, and I had a very solid childhood. My family is very supportive of me and everything I do. The one thing that I will say about my family that was prevalent within both sides of the family was there was alcoholism. And that was something that was not spoken about, that it was something that was not discussed. And it was somewhat of a normal situation for me as a kid, spending time with a large Italian family and Polish family. We spent a lot of time at dinner, drinking, playing cards, having a good time, and, fighting and arguing and doing what big families do. Not necessarily a non-loving family, but we drank a lot. And from a very young age, it was something that was very normal to me.
Yeah. So, well, in retrospect, you can now look back at that as a sort of family propensity towards abusing alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't viewed that way by you, right? It was just It was a lifestyle.
Yes, it was a lifestyle, and it was something that, again, we had some family members that would pass away, or we had some people that on one side of the family would pass away of the disease of alcoholism, and it really wasn't a conversation. It was a celebration of their life, but that part of their conversation was not in the mix. And I understand that because we were young.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was normalized. And not to say that there's not people that can do that without having issues, concerns, or problems, or consequences,
mm-hmm.
which I, you know, in my story, I really didn't have a whole lot of consequences until I did.
Yeah.
So,
well, you're also
talking, but it was more of a lifestyle. I agree.
Yeah, you're also talking about a generation where people may have been aware of drinking too much, and certainly they're aware when people die because of alcohol-related problems.
Mm-hmm.
It probably wasn't viewed as a disease, right?
Probably not. Being 52, I'm guessing that when I was a kid, the AMA and none of the medical society had really identified anything, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, even if they did, you know what the attitudes were. This was, at worst, a character flaw,
yes.
or something that, you know, people did to themselves. So, it was a different time. Mm-hmm. That attitude still prevails, unfortunately, in certain quarters.
Absolutely.
Growing up, was anybody in your family that you were aware of in any kind of 12-step program or any kind of treatment program?
No.
So that
that I know of, right. I don't believe so. Mm-hmm. I don't believe anyone even acknowledged that there was issues or that there was a concern. I know my mother's father was a typical alcoholic who spent his check and spent very little time with family and did some things that we found out about. And when he passed, the strangest part of that was the funeral. It was very, very grim. There was very little emotion,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which was one of the first times that I ever seen something like that in my life.
What do you think? What do you think surrounded that passing? Sort of relief,
relief and a sadness, but no crying.
Right. So you
anywhere
you grow up in a situation where, and we know that this happens in lots of families, that there's a history of substance abuse of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about the generation you are, we've already described how they would have related to it. So there was nothing in your childhood growing up that would have alerted you to a propensity you may have had to abuse alcohol. Right?
I don't believe so. There may have been some propensities for me as a budding alcoholic without alcohol, with extremities, with sports, and with everything that I did. I wanted to be the best, and I excelled at everything I did. If I didn't excel, I worked at it to excel at it. Be it golf, bowling, baseball, anything that I put my mind to. I was a varsity sports. I was in varsity sports for 4 years or plus,
mm-hmm.
and rolled perfect games in bowling and caught double headers in baseball when, it's 100 degrees out.
Right,
So played with injuries, all those things that are kind of signs of an extreme personality.
Yeah, well, except only in retrospect. When they're occurring, they're signs of high achieving, hard work, perseverance, and all that. The problem is that when you apply all those good attributes in sports or life to abusing alcohol, then they become negatives, obviously. But, I mean, it's interesting because the face of this disease, because of the size of it now and the pervasiveness of it, has changed from a time when young people used to say, I felt isolated, alone, I didn't fit in anywhere. So I gravitated towards a group that used drugs and alcohol. You were a high achiever. You probably were a popular kid growing up, right?
I was, but I was also one of those chameleons that fit into everywhere I needed to fit into. And I was the youngest of three. And the one thing about being the youngest of three is I found that I was chasing a lot. I was chasing a lot of different things. I was chasing a lot of things that my brother or sister were doing or success. And I think that's kind of an early sign. Of extreme personality, which is what I see with the people that I work with in recovery, that I try to help. I see those kinds of, or hear those kinds of stories, mm-hmm. about extreme personalities, be it sports driven, be it drinking driven, be it drugging driven, mm-hmm. be it work driven.
Mm-hmm.
It brings to mind the word that my sponsors, numerous sponsors, have said about balance, and that's the ultimate goal, is to achieve more of a better balance in my life.
It's interesting to hear you say this, and I know you work with people who are in recovery. Parents listening to something like this would go, thank God my kids are involved in sports. It's occupying their life and times, and maybe this will keep them away from bad habits. And you seem to be saying that that's true, but parents should be alert to the fact that if their kids are striving mightily socially, mm-hmm. and in sports, there should be some joy in that and not a kind of desperation.
But I think there's a strive for perfection in society, mm-hmm. and which really in recovery you realize that perfection is not achievable. It's okay to strive for it, but it's also okay to understand that it's a very difficult, if it's not difficult, it's impossible,
mm-hmm.
but it's something you need to strive for, mm-hmm. a perfection in some sort of a field or something you do. My children are very, very, very driven children, mm-hmm. and I look at them not just worry about everything, but I also worry about those behaviors that I see in myself that may or may not bring out something else when times go, and I talk about this a little more detail, but when times go wrong or when things are not going well, what do you reach for, right, and where do you go?
How old are your children, Nick?
My children are 21, 19, and going to be 14.
Are they aware of your background or your story?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So let's take a moment before we take our first break and begin the story, mm-hmm, of when alcohol and then I guess other substances become a problem for you. Did you begin drinking, mm-hmm, like anybody might have from your circumstances, from your social group?
Or tell, pardon?
Us about it. Tell us about your introduction to drinking and then other stuff.
Well, I just like any other kid, my brothers and sisters had parties and did some things, and when I was probably 14, I would say I had my first drink and got, completely out of control, didn't understand what was going on, got sick, enjoyed the feeling of not having to, again, as a young child, not having to be perfect, having a release of some sort. And that was one of the things. I mean, did we drink beers or sip things when we were little kids? Yes. I mean, it was kind of an Italian thing. Drank a glass of wine. I mean, mm-hmm, there was no extreme to that. It was just part of life, and it was part of our heritage, quite frankly, without extremes for me. I mean, I hear different stories. I hear that it was, I fell in love with it the first time. I don't know that that was the case. I just know that it was something that became very normal for me.
Nick Antos is our guest. He's with us to describe his problems with alcohol and substance abuse and in and out of some treatment facilities, and now 6 years sober. We'll continue with Nick's story straight ahead. Please don't go away. This is Recovery Radio. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. On the phone with us is Nick Antos. Nick is 52 years old and has struggled with alcohol primarily for many years in his life. He is now in 6 years of sobriety and telling us the story of his struggles and how he managed to achieve that sobriety. So Nick, your history of alcohol use is so typical. We hear it so many times. You're a young guy and 14 years old and you start having some alcohol. How quickly did it accelerate for you to a problem?
Well, I got through high school, being the weekend, kind of the binge kind of guy. And I got through high school and primarily alcohol couldn't take precedence over my other responsibilities, at least for me at that time, being on a number of sports teams, being on a number of different organizations and being, in the school, being part of the school board and things of that nature at school, I had to manage my usage, and I did that for a number of years, and I never really had any consequences because of that usage. Certainly some things I shouldn't have done. But my brother and sister, I love them dearly, but my brother and sister did worse things than I, and I, as a good, intelligent alcoholic, I realized what I could and could not do to avoid consequences. And I was smart enough not to drive a whole lot drunk, and smart enough not to do the things that I've heard other people have done. Doesn't make me better; just makes it a different learning curve for me. And I went to college and got into college pretty easily, and went to college and spent some time at school. And at school, I found drinking and drugs to be a pretty good combination. And I went to school in the 80s, so the drug of choice was cocaine at that time.
Yeah, cocaine, God's way of telling you you've got too much money. You know what's interesting about, and again, and again, it's your, this story is familiar. I like to say around here, all stories of substance abuse and recovery are the same, except they're different. But you point out, as many others have on this program, the pernicious nature of this disease. The better you are at handling it, and you sound like you were high functioning, even though you were abusing alcohol, the better you are at that, the worse you're off.
Yeah, I think what happens is you start to understand where lines are, and for me it was a gradual process. For some people it's a much more, from what I understand, the people that I deal with or people that I talk to, it's a completely different process. But the bottom line is that process was progressive. That process remains progressive, and
is leading
highly functioning is a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
When you meet somebody at college that is prolific at having drugs and having drugs be available to you, and you become somewhat, you say about high about amount of money. Really didn't have I didn't have to spend any money. So that was a bit of another. A bonus or benefit of that.
What do you mean you didn't have to spend any money? You mean on alcohol?
Or on drugs at all.
The people just giving it to you?
I can't get into it. There's too many legal ramifications. You've mentioned my name. So
okay.
I will not get into it from that perspective.
So in other words, the standard trope here is that somebody who's abusing drugs or alcohol, particularly drugs, now has to resort to all sorts of crazy behavior, illegal perhaps, in order to get the drugs.
Correct.
You didn't have any of those problems.
There was illegal behavior, but it was close to home. It was close with friends at school.
Okay.
And it made it very easy for me to acquire whatever drug or whatever I needed. It was a job.
I got it.
So as well as personal use.
Yeah. So when does it become a problem? Doesn't sound like a problem so far. When does it become a problem?
Looking back on it, it was a problem in school. It made it more difficult for me to really buckle down and do what I had to do. I played some sports in school, so I had to continue to manage those things. Sleep was rare. I had a job in college, so I managed the job. I managed the sports. I tried to manage everything, and I managed to get through college, which I'm still stunned that they gave me a degree and that I found a way to do so. You know, my story, if you want to know when, I can give you some more background, but I graduated college and got a job within about a month, which was disappointing because I didn't want to go to work that quickly, but I got a job where I had an expense account and I had the ability to travel and be by myself and car and benefits and bonuses, and I drank on the road with clients, and I thought that was normal, but I also drank after I was done. And I did have some altercations or some communicational problems with customers early in my career of sales. And I was a very, very functional, very good salesperson and was very, very good at solving people's problems with the clients or with the customers or with the people that we worked for. And I did that for a number of companies for a number of years, but there was a pattern of me being let go because of my behavior, attitude, and a lot of it did circle or center around being at a convention or being somewhere and being drunk and saying the wrong thing, you know, which should have been a notification that there was an issue and that I may need to take a look at it and address that. I did not do any drugs after that, which is stunning. I stopped doing the cocaine as soon as I graduated college, but I certainly graduated into a little bit heavier drinking, more of a business setting kind of a drinking. And again, in those years, it wasn't frowned upon. You're looking at the 90s, and there were drinking lunches, and there were things like that, and there were massive conventions with a lot of, you know, open bar and things of that nature.
Sure,
so.
Sure.
I traveled the world too.
We're gonna go into the next. We're gonna take a break here now. But when we come back, we'll find out when this series of unfortunate incidents fueled by alcohol became impossible, I guess, to ignore.
Yes.
Nick Antos is our guest on Recovery Radio. We have more of Nick's story straight ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you here on Saturdays. The whole shooting match is sponsored by the good people at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. And before you think this is a commercial, it is only modestly so. I tell you every week that Retreat sponsors this program as an informational and educational tool, and they mean that. Now, are they a world-class organization with a sterling reputation? Yes. Have they helped lots of people? Sure, they have. Can they help you? I don't know. But I do know that when I give you their phone number, they're there to answer questions for you about anything you've heard on the program, any questions you might have about your circumstances, any questions at all. That's what this program is dedicated for. I give you Retreat's phone number. You'll get no better advice or treatment or help than from Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. We give you the phone number every week and tell you the same thing. We hope you never have to use this. But in a moment of extreme pressure and problems, this could be a difference maker. 855-859-8808. That's how you reach Retreat. 855-859-8808. Nick Antos has been telling us his story of alcohol abuse, substance abuse, which to back up a bit so that we get the whole picture here going into the segment, Nick has described as manageable to a certain degree. From a very early age, he managed to go through his educational life as a young man, drinking heavily and doing cocaine and not screwing his educational experience up. And as an early person in the business world, he managed a series of successful jobs for a while that he, again, handled with very few consequences. But, Nick, something changed. What was the consequence that finally made this behavior impossible to ignore?
Well, to talk about the job experiences, I traveled quite a bit and spent a lot of time away from my family and not being a very good father. And those things weigh on you very quickly. And one of the things that I did when I traveled was I drank and I didn't drink to the consequences. I didn't drive. I was not to the point where I made poor decisions, but I started to kind of ignore my responsibilities. I started to ignore my wife. I started to not be very present with my children. I was at every single one of their games. I was at all their different events. I helped coach some of their teams. But the stress and the pressure of life and trying to keep up with the Joneses and do those things was weighing on me. And I believe I was 39 or 40. I'm not sure exactly. I can't even remember what year it was. Mm-hmm. But I had a very high-stress job, and I was doing some things, and things were changing at work, and it was affecting income, and it was one of those things that that I held very highly, is that, you know, having enough money, having enough power, having enough prestige, and all those things were important. And it was deteriorating my marriage, and I was being told that, and I wasn't really listening to it. And it came down to the point eventually where my wife had come to me and said, "I'm leaving you." And we were married for probably 17 years, and with three young children at that time, and a job, and all these different things. And back up a little bit, my father had a stroke a couple of years back. There were some things that weren't going very well, and I was losing my sanity. Let's just say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to manage it, as we talked about. And I went to the doctor and said, "I don't know what to do. I'm having panic attacks. I'm having issues. I don't know what to do." And I was diagnosed, with stress, with high stress, and the job was part of it. And I wasn't going to leave the job because of the money and because of the things that I had, the responsibilities I had. But, the doctor put me on Xanax, and I honestly fell in love with Xanax because it was instant alcohol for me. It gave me the instant feel of alcohol, and I combined it with alcohol, told not to do so, combined it with alcohol, and I did not have any seizures, which is a miracle. To this day, I'm being told by doctors, the things that I did, I should have died for sure from seizures alone. And when she left, I had a free run, so to speak, and I used those drugs and alcohol to drown out my feelings about how badly or how poorly, how much of a failure I had been in my marriage.
Yeah, this diagnosis you were given was by your family physician.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you mention to him that you drank heavily?
No.
So he would have he would have no way of knowing that he was handing you a loaded pistol.
No, of course not.
Yeah, yeah. And you still at that point didn't immediately connect the alcohol with any of these problems. You just thought it was a combination of the way of your life.
Right. It was stress in life and money issues and family issues and those things that, you know, that society tells us are part of life. But there was certainly no spiritual, I'm a Catholic, recovering Catholic, but there was no reaching for help outside of myself, because I will say that I was always self-sufficient. I was always raised that I could do whatever I could do. And I don't blame that on my parents. It's just because both of my parents were basically single. They had single parents back in eras when there were none. My father never had a father. My mother had a father who was never around. So they're very self-sufficient individuals that were very successful business people from a very young age together, and then raised three children to the best of their ability. But there was there's something inside of me that said that this is something that I can handle. This is something that I have to do.
Yeah. Well, it's the... That's the manly thing, right? That's what, you know, you have to do, right?
Very much so. Yeah. So generationally, very much so.
Yeah, sure. a lot of generations are like that. You're chasing the American dream, and it was killing you. Let's focus on. So the marriage falls apart. You're prescribed Xanax, which you combine now with alcohol. Where does that lead you, Nick?
Puts me in a bad spot. Makes me lose my job. Makes me not want to do anything. Gives me the ability to not care about anything. No more bills, no more anything. My life is falling apart, and I'm okay with it. Because I'm a failure in my mind, and the drugs and alcohol help me stay in that mode, stay in that place where, it's devastating. I don't understand. I've not, if you listen to my story, I've not been unsuccessful, so I don't understand failure.
When did you, when, if ever, did you come to the realization that, what had happened to you, particularly the abuse of drugs and alcohol, was something you had no control over? I mean, you didn't have any control over it, even though it may have seemed like,
I kind of came to the realization when I was at my home, a very large home, and my wife was still living in the home, and I had walked down the street to a friend who I knew was in recovery. And for whatever reason, I don't know what made me do it. I will call that one of my first God moments for me. Mm-hmm. I just walked down to his house and I said, I don't know what to do. He said, well, you crashed a car the other day. You didn't crash it, but you broke it. You smacked up, a mailbox, did some things. He said, you're getting worse. And there was a solution. And we sat down in his living room, and I was like, oh, well, I'm here. I mean, I got nothing to do. I got no job. I'm not employable at this point. Mm-hmm. People feel sorry for me. But I never went to my company and asked for help, which I could have. The company was a multi-billion-dollar, multinational company, global company. They would have done anything for me if I'd have asked. But it was too late, and I got myself let go because I stopped doing my job.
When you went,
and he talked to me, he talked to me at length about recovery.
Yeah,
about AA.
Let me ask you. Well, as you sat in front of him, and he was telling you that it's getting bad, worse for you, and here's a path. For instance, were you listening to him thinking, well, I'll try this, but he's not really talking about me. I don't have these problems. Or were you going,
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I was also in a place where I wasn't very clear. I wasn't able to. I wasn't sober. I wasn't listening with a sober mind. If I look at it, I heard everything he said, and it sounded phenomenal. Not to say that I didn't agree with his diagnosis, so to speak, of me or me diagnosing myself. I just wasn't ready. I wasn't clear, and I certainly didn't want to stop. So. For me, I wasn't in a place where I was willing to go to any length to stop.
How did you get to that spot, Nick? Because I know you had a couple of trips into rehab before you got sober, right?
I got to that point where I was highly suicidal. I was to a point where I had cut my hand almost completely off in a fit of psychosis, and laid bleeding for 2 days. Not to be graphic, I don't like to be, but woke up 2 days later alive and angry at God for not taking me. I got to a point where I was told that everybody gets to where you don't know whether you want to live or die, but you don't want to live the way you're living. And even after that, I was upset that I didn't achieve my goal. So I went, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to handle this. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I went to treatment, kicking and screaming, even with that, kicking and screaming. I'm very upset that I didn't pass, because that's what I wanted. I didn't think anybody in my family needed me. I didn't think any of my family deserved to have a father like me, or a son or a brother or anything like me. I was taught in treatment that I am important. It does matter. And that, you know, I got myself into a place where the drugs took over my life and the alcohol took over my life. And, I believe those traumas lined up a bit. I believe traumas will line up and your brain kind of shuts down. And my go-to was alcohol and drugs.
Yeah.
It always has been.
Yes.
But it was really my go-to at that point.
Yeah. Nick, when we come back, we'll bring folks up to date on where you are today. As I said at the beginning, 6 years now, mm-hmm. sober. Nick Antos, mm-hmm. our guest on Recovery Radio. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you here on Saturdays. We talk about the disease of addiction and often bring in people who tell us about their struggles and how they saw their way clear, many of them, to long-term successful sobriety. That's the case with our guest on the telephone, Nick Antos. Nick's a 52-year-old, paragon of the American dream, hardworking family man who unfortunately succumbed to alcohol and substance abuse, got a handle on that after having shattered his family and his life, and now he's 6 years sober. So where are you today, Nick, with regards to your backstory, your career, and how you feel about the, you know, Nick Antos, former substance abuser?
Well, I've been... I'd be remiss in not saying, you know, without AA, without numerous people in my life that have stuck by me and have done things for me that I thought they would never do, considering the way I've treated them in the past and under the influence or not, I'm in a better place. I look at recovery. My recovery includes, three things in my life. I need to trust God. I need to clean my house on a daily basis, and I mean physically as well as mentally. And I need to do things like this that are important for me to give back, and that is to help others. And if my story or if my conversation is recognizable, that's what I found worked for me. And just to go back a little bit, the treatment facilities were very, very helpful and very, very educational. In a lot of cases, I wasn't very willing. I wasn't very open to suggestions. I was extremely belligerent at a lot of places, including the retreat. Mm-hmm. But I did have a few people get to me. I had a few people get into my head and say, you know, one guy in West Palm Beach would say to me all the time, he'd say, listen, how's your way working out for you? You know, how's it working?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be like, and I couldn't, for the first time in my life, I couldn't say anything. I had no comeback, no snappy remark. And those guys, those old timers down there, my last sponsor passed away a few years back, had 63 years of sobriety, and he was a happy dude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I spent some time with those guys at a Monday night meeting in West Palm Beach. You know, at 9 o'clock in the evening, eating cookies and talking about recovery with guys that around the table, nobody had less than 40 years. And they were really happy dudes. And they were not just, misogynists. They weren't just saying, it's perfect, it's great. They were reality people. They were people that I talked to, when I was really struggling, I talked to those people and said, what do I do? And they would say, just do this or just do that. And very simple things that were so common sense that, you get wrapped up in life and you get wrapped up in kids and career and just things that you start to lose sight of what's important. And they told me what was important, and what was important was, if I'm not sober, I can't be of help to anyone. I can't be of service to God or my fellow man. And, and some people don't like to hear about God, but for me, this is a different God, that I was introduced to. I was given the opportunity to shed my religion and look at spirituality in a different fashion and live my life very simply based on some simple rules, which were, try not to hurt somebody, try to help somebody each day. And if you do something wrong, go to that person and make it right.
You mentioned
and part of the process, part of the process of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous for me was going through those steps. And today I try to incorporate them in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't work them anymore. I try to live them.
Right. So you're not going to meetings currently?
I do.
Oh, you do?
Oh, I do. Okay. Absolutely. I go to meetings all over the country. I travel quite extensively, and I go to meetings wherever I can.
So, Nick, have you gotten to the point after 6 years now of sobriety to understand more fully what those old timers meant by this is better than what you're doing?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. And it's very, and again, when your hair's on fire and you're still trying to figure out a way as to why your brain's fried from all the benzos and all the things that you've done for years and years and years, until you start to clear and until you start to experience what they're talking about, for me, I have to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys were living it. Those guys were going fishing. Those guys were playing golf with me. Those guys were doing some fun things. They were also pushing me to continue to talk at treatment facilities, to talk to, there was a place in Florida called CARP. And I try to continue that process as much as possible. When somebody asks me to do something, I do it. Unless I have a really, really important excuse, which my important excuse is I have to be with my mother who's not well, or I have to be with my children who need me or would like to see me, watch them play sports and just enjoy the space and the time with them. But otherwise, it's very, very prevalent in my life. It used to be on a daily basis. Sometimes it can be, sometimes it can't be. But in my experience, if I want to find it, it's there.
Nick Antos,
I'm
sorry, go ahead, Nick.
Go ahead. I have many friends that I consider lifelong friends that, it's rare to have even two or three real friends. I mean, I believe that. And that's important to me.
Well, Nick, you proved once again that everybody's road and path to a whole and sober life is different. But, it doesn't matter. Getting to where you are now is all that matters. Nick Antos, mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Nick. You're a great storyteller about your life, and it sounds like it's together for you. Appreciate it.
Today it's good. We'll work on tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. Nick Antos, thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Everybody, enjoy the rest of your weekend and look for us on Saturdays here on Recovery Radio. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.